Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely. This is one in a series of special shows celebrating the 20th anniversary of Peach Pit Press. Joining me for this program is Robin Williams, an icon in the Mac community and the author of dozens of best-selling and award-winning books about the Macintosh, including the groundbreaking The Little Mac book and Robin Williams' Mac OS X book. Possibly her greatest achievement, which I'll ask her about, is educating and influencing an entire generation of computer users in design, typography, desktop publishing, and, of course, the Mac and the web at large. Through her writing, teaching, and seminars, and her ability to be accessible through all of those means, as a Mac devotee myself, I warmly welcome Robin to the A-List. Hello!
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks so much for having me. You make me sound like I'm something.
Well, you are. You know, you share a name with somebody very, very famous as well. So I have to start with that question is, you know, how is it to have the name Robin Williams, being a woman? Is there any funny story you can share off the top?
Oh, there's too many funny stories, but actually they're sad because what happens is I disappoint everybody. Everywhere I go, I check into a hotel and they say, oh, you're Robin Williams.
I'm not
reservation at a restaurant and they say, oh, you're Robin Williams. So it's kind of sad, actually.
You're on the A-List now, so we'll change
that. Oh, boy.
Let's move on to your books. Obviously, very popular with Mac users everywhere. A sense of, you know, and obviously you do teaching and you meet so many people. Why do you think your books resonate with readers more than others?
Well, I'm kind of pleased to hear they resonate more than others, but I think what has happened is I tend to write the book that I want to have, and I'm always very conscious of the beginner, the person who is feeling a little uncomfortable, because I was at first with my first computer, and I've always remembered that. Or I remember when, you know, getting Lion and thinking, oh, my God, it's so crazy making. So I'm always sort of right there with the person who's newly learning it, and I think that probably helps.
Right, and it definitely comes across to all of us. You know, I have to ask with that Lion question, one question that I think probably a lot of Mac users have is, how do you use the widgets, and are they useful to you?
Well, the widgets are, you mean widgets? I mean,
you
widgets
know how
are
you,
sort of,
the
yeah.
slide off to the other screen widgets that the actual interface has now.
Yeah, widgets were actually a couple of OSs ago when they were first introduced, and apparently they didn't do as well as they thought they would, so now they've been sort of relegated to this space that you accidentally get to because you know, flail around on your magic mouse. So my impression was is that in Lion they're sort of phasing them out. There weren't many new ones, and they're not doing very exciting things. And this is just my impression, is that widgets are sort of moving away, and we're moving into the apps instead.
Yeah, I wish so much that space wouldn't be the thing you fly off to, because
yeah.
You know, it does feel like, you know, I didn't get a great sense of using them before. And now I fly off them. So I had to ask an expert here, I've got one, what you thought of them. So,
yeah, I would suggest if you don't find them useful at all, and they're getting less useful as time goes by, go to your preferences and tell, I think it's in the mission control preferences, where you can uncheck the box that says give dashboard its own space. And if you uncheck that box, then you won't accidentally get there when you're flailing around in your mouth.
Great tip. Love tips. That's fabulous. So of course, we're talking about Lion, and you've got a couple new books out about it. In general, do you think that people, do you have a viewpoint on whether people should upgrade right now or not, and why, one way or the other? And maybe a best feature that you can name as a reason one way or the other.
Well, it's always, I find the same thing every time they upgrade the OS. I think, oh, gosh, what do I, you know, do I really need that? And then I work on the book for a few months, and when I go back to the previous operating system, there are things I miss. Like,
yeah.
Oh, where's that? Where's that? So, and it's so inexpensive, and you can get one copy and use it on all your computers.
I did have a little bit of an issue.
Yeah, that was a smart move. I did have a little bit of an issue at first on my old Mac Air. It didn't seem to be quite fast enough. So if you have an old machine, I might wait. But otherwise, there's no reason not to. And
so, is there any new feature that you really like about it that you think would make it worth someone, you know, maybe a student that's like, hey, $30 is a few meals for me, to make the switch?
Well, there probably are. But I finished the book, you know, a month ago. And I can't install it on my main machine because I'm under deadline for two books, and I have a rule, no new technology under deadline.
Yeah.
So I haven't been using it on my big machine. But there were things I missed. I missed the magic mouse and the scrolling things flying around that I can do. And I'm sure there's something else I missed, but I've forgotten it.
I like my magic. And I like the trackpad, actually, the action on the trackpad being different.
Uh-huh.
But I always get I'm backwards still, and I'm trying. I don't want to set it to be any different so I can use another machine and still use it correctly. But
it's actually not that you're backwards. It's that they have switched it so that instead of scrolling the way we always have on a Mac, it now scrolls with Lion in your trackpad or your Magic Mouse. It scrolls the way we do on an iPad. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. So once you get accustomed to that, then you're able to do the same on both your trackpad and on your Mac, and it'll take a few days before your mind stops telling you you're doing it backwards.
Yeah, I know. It's so weird because I go between the 27-inch big machine, and then I'll be traveling and have the my MacBook Pro, and I'll get used to it on the MacBook Pro, and then I have the mouse introduced again, I get confused. So anyway,
we're easily confused, aren't we?
Yeah. I am anyway. Well, I'll be the one to claim that. But you also have some great new non-designers books out too. Do you consider yourself a non-designer, and what does that mean to you?
Well, actually, that's the only credential I have is in design, just an AA degree. But that was how I made a living for years.
Something.
What?
Don't ever put down credentials. That's something, right?
Yeah. So what I realized over the years with the Mac is that it really did this wonderful thing about raising our consciousness about what looks good on a page. And whereas years ago you could get away with ugly flyers, it's less you're less able to get away with that now because everyone's consciousness has been raised about design. But not everybody can go to design school, but thousands and thousands of people want to make their own advertising look better, or their flyers, their brochures, their books that they're having self-published. So it's a huge market of people who can't go to design school but really want to make it look a little better. So that's what that entire series is for.
That's fabulous. And I mean, you know, where did you start with that whole concept? Because it seems like, I know for me, and talking to Scott Kelby yesterday, another of Peach Pit's wonderful authors, we were talking about Photoshop, and I know if one thing changes in the and if you go from CS4 to CS5, the default little icon thingies change, whatever those are called, functions on the left hand side. You know, and I'm very much a non designer. But I'm, you know, creating graphics because I have to. We all kind of have to these days, right? And it's interesting, sort of. I take someone like myself and I think, how would you start? You know, how would you start to take your skills and sort of dumb that down for someone like me who, you know, I mean, where did you start?
Well, two things. In the original non-designer's design book, which is Mac and PC, it doesn't matter what kind of computer you're on, It was distilled from years of teaching graphic design in the community college. So I narrowed it down to four of the basic principles. I mean, they're not like I didn't invent these principles, but I narrowed them down to the four most important and discovered that if you can name something, if you can, you know, we can both look at a flyer and say, oh, this one's ugly and this one's really nice. But what's more difficult is putting your finger on, why does this one look dorky? And if you can put your finger on it, if you can say, oh, it's missing this, then you can fix it. If you're just floating around in the dark, not understanding it, well, I don't know why, look, I can't, you know, if you can't put it into words why it doesn't work, then you can't get anywhere. So the first book was defining those four principles and explaining them clearly so that I used to give a lot of workshops in this. And it was so wonderful to see people say, oh, I see.
You changed my life. It's wonderful.
Yeah, people tell me that. The ones we're working on now are the non-designer's InDesign book, the non-designer's Photoshop book, and the non-designer's Illustrator book, because so many of us have the whole suite. Like, I live in InDesign, but I don't know Photoshop for beans. But my partner, John, spends a huge amount of time in Photoshop, so he wrote the non-designer's Photoshop book. And I learned so much. And in his way he approached it was, what are the things people need to do most? Okay, you want to get rid of red eye. Okay, you want to crop this photo, but you don't want to get rid of anything in the middle. Do you want to do? You want to make yourself look 10 pounds skinnier? So there's a big portion of it is, all I want to know is how to do that. You know, take the gray out of my hair, that's all.
That's fabulous. Well, I'll be buying that book just to figure out the 10 pounds part.
Yeah, I learned a lot from that book.
I love that. That's a great, great concept. So useful. So now you and I have to admit myself, I have recently been on a font kick, and you're a font fan. So do you have favorite fonts, and are there fonts that you hate?
Hate Helvetica, Arial, same thing, Sam. and Comic Sans, whatever it is. Hate, loathe, despise.
The web compatible fonts that everybody tries to make you use.
Well, Helvetica really isn't even a web compatible font. If you notice, if you put it in Helvetica, it looks heavy and unpleasant. And if you change it to, say, Verdana, which was designed for the web, oh my gosh, it's instantly so much more readable and pleasant. You can tell instantly when you go to a page with Helvetica body copy that it's just wrong. But, you know, people love Helvetica. That's okay. Favorites, it changes all the time. All the time.
Really? What's right now? what's your right now?
Brioso Pro. Brioso is my favorite serif font for body copy. But
how
it's such a favorite that Brioso.
Okay.
But it's such a favorite that I only use it for my own projects that are dear to my heart.
That's
pretty
cool.
Garamond in my books. And
Garamond in your books?
Yeah, Garamond I think is probably the most readable typeface in the whole ever invented in the history of the world. But I love display faces and I love script faces and I probably have hundreds and hundreds of scripts and display fonts that are just so much fun to use. And I collect sans serifs because it's funny, sans serifs look so similar if you don't know what you're looking at.
Uh-huh.
But then when it comes down to using them in a project, you find, oh, this one's too roundy. Oh, this one's got the X height's too big. Oh, this one is too pointy. So I keep collecting them because every time I use one, I need exactly the right one. So I'm a big fan of, I have a huge collection of sans serif fonts too.
I got to ask you this because I've done this before and I'm embarrassed to say it. So maybe you can come along with me on this little quest. Have you ever looked up your own name and like looked at font collections that have been created around your name? think I found Jennifer's handwriting.
Oh, no, I thought you...
It's a pretty recent one. There was one called Jennifer's Handwriting that I found on font.com. Like, I'll do that occasionally. I don't know why. It sounds so nutty. But, just to stumble across new things, because there are so many fonts these days and so many creators.
Yeah, and you have to limit it somehow.
Yeah, so I've done that before. Is there any interesting way that you search for new fonts, or how do you come across new ones? I mean, can you identify them pretty easily when you're reading through something, or do you grab it and go, I gotta find?
Oh no, when I was teaching typography before the Mac came out, that was one of our things we did, was identify fonts, but there were only 25 in town, so. No, I've given up trying to identify fonts, but I do belong to the mailing list from Xeer and myfonts.com and Font House. And I'm such a slut for fonts. Every time they send me a newsletter, I, have to have that one. So lately that's been where my collection has come from, because they put them right in front of my face, and what can I do?
Robin, do me a favor and send me the links to those, and we'll add them to my blog post if other folks that are font sluts can go and get on those newsletter lists, and we'll help those websites grow, and maybe you can get a commission out of them or something. my husband is English, and he can quote Shakespearean sonnets. So as a transition here, I have found out that you are a Shakespeare buff, and I want to know how you got interested in that.
All of us have the work we do, and then we have the things that we're really also interested in. Maria Langner flies helicopters, and so it's been an interest of mine for a long time, but I did just go back to London for a year last year and got a master's in Shakespeare studies, and I'm actually working on my doctorate right now in Shakespeare. I don't know what I'll do with it, because there's no money in Shakespeare, so I don't know. I'm just doing it because I love it, and I'm hoping
but you know
it turns
that,
out
I love I love that, because part of one of the themes of this show overall is sort of passion that fuels the journey of people that have really made a name for themselves, because I really believe that we're defined by the totality of us as people, not just what we do for a living. So I think that's really interesting, because I hopefully that will encourage other people to let other interests continue to inspire them, because I think it makes our work better. We stay focused on our work and our output's really good, and then we move on to the things that we love and are we can be equally passionate about, but in a different way.
Yeah, and I found that in my particular field, knowing how to design and knowing how to use type and fonts and stuff has been hugely useful in everything else that I do. You know, my research papers I turn in look so nice, and my handouts for my classes, I think when things look better on paper, it's not only that they look nice, but they communicate more clearly and they garner more respect if they look nice. So I think design and typography is one of the most important things anybody can ever learn. So it's coming useful. All of it's coming useful.
I find that to be so true. If you can read something and like it, and another book that I love is Don't Make Me Think, and guess who's on tomorrow? Steve Krug.
I love that book.
I feel like it's such a great compliment to what you do. You know, it's like you can just get deeper into UI, UX, just all of these things. And, it makes us better at what we do, no matter which piece of the web we're working on. Like how psychology can influence. I would love to read a white paper on how the psychology of fonts and how that typography is taken in, because looking at the Brioso font that you had mentioned, I love it because you have a very, I love your picture. You have such a great look. Designers always have this very gorgeous look about them, and it matches, it looks like just this beautiful extension of you into type. It's lovely. So before we finish off on Shakespeare, any favorite a play, a sonnet, anything that you want to share with us?
No, I tend to, I like little tiny wee pieces, and I tend to post them all over the place, like, I will be bright and shine and pearl and gold. know, little tiny things. You know, like, and so it was with me when I was young. I think, oh, yeah.
It sounds like all these little tiny ones.
What?
This is like a theme for a Robin Shakespeare Twitter account. You need to grab that handle today. And as you think of them, share them with the world.
Well, I have a website, theshakespearepapers.com, where I get to combine my Shakespeare stuff with design. And every 2 months, John and I produce a little 20-page full-color booklet that's about some little tiny piece of Shakespeare. And we get to redesign them every 2 months. You know, we're the client. So it's been this wonderful combination for me that I wish I could make money on. For now, it's
just... You never know. You never
my
know.
Passion.
Stranger things have happened. If blank, my dad says, could become a TV show, which didn't do well, but was still sold for, I'm sure, quite a bit of money to Hollywood. You never know. A Twitter channel of little bits of what you're putting together with the ShakespearePapers.com could become something huge. Who knows?
I hope it happens in my lifetime.
So now this is another area. So I was an English major as an undergrad. So I critical theory and all of that was, you know, towards the end to do your honor stuff you have to get into. But I loved getting lost in prose. And you wrote a book called Sweet Swan of Avalon that suggests
Avon.
That Shakespeare. Avon, sorry.
Yeah. that's a different woman.
Different, not talking about the cosmetics company, again, getting confused with me. It suggests that a woman wrote Shakespeare. So do you still believe that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, why? A little bit of the why.
It's nothing to do with, it's not like I'm saying, ooh, Shakespeare writes like a girl. It's nothing to do with that. It's just that there's no documented evidence that Shakespeare was a writer. We have evidence he was an actor, et cetera. But there's actually no recorded evidence of being paid for writing, et cetera. So, and there's been a question. It's been a question for hundreds of years. And the sonnets are written to a man. Most of them are written to men. So that was what led me to that possibility. And I wrote the book, and Peach Pit was kind enough. Bless their hearts. Peach Pit has been the best thing in my life for a long time. They published it in hardback. It's sold out now, and it's going into paperback soon. But it's a side thing, you know. It's something that nothing will ever make money on. But again, it's one of those things that I just had to do for some reason. I don't know why.
Very, very
actually,
cool.
My master's in London, I'm actually the first American with a post-grad degree in Shakespearean authorship. It was a master's to study the question of, what is this about Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare?
That's awesome. So now, since we're celebrating Peach Pit, and you've said some lovely things there, how did you start writing books for Peach Pit?
It was one of those fortuitous accidents. I had been turned down by 10 publishers and I wanted to write my first computer book because who are you? You know, you're just a ball of soap. We don't know who you are. And they all turned me down, but I was teaching a HyperCard class. And so I decided to, you know, I'm a designer. I know how to produce a book. I just didn't know how to sell it. So I self-published my first two books, Little MacBook and The Mac is Not a Typewriter. I took them to Macworld, maybe it was Siebold, and showed them to a guy who used to run the Berkeley Mac User Group back when they had like 20,000 members. And he said, oh, great, we love to take these MacBooks apart. We rip them to shreds.
Oh, my goodness.
And they liked it. They liked it, and it got back to Peach Pit, and Peach Pit only had two or three books on their list at the time, and it's a long story about how wonderful Ted Nace was to me at Peach Pit, and so they had very few books, and this was my first book, and so we kind of grew up together. They trusted me that I was a teacher and I knew how to teach the material in my book. And so they didn't force me into a computer book mold sort of thing. And so by allowing me to do what I do pretty well, my books did well for them, and they did well for me. And I think I've published like 65 books with Peach Pit now, and it's been just a wonderful. They make me feel appreciated and honored, and they pay me well, and it's just been magical.
Aww. So you talked about Ted, is it, from the Peach Pit team?
Ted Mace is the one who started Peach Pit, yeah.
That's fabulous. So who do you work with now that you'd love to give a shout-out to as we celebrate the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit?
Nancy Renzel, publisher, of course, and Nancy Davis, who was my editor for many years, and Nikki McDonald, who has been my editor the past, 8 or 9 books, and Keesley, and I mean, they just have a wonderful family of people over there. Some of them, like Keesley, have been there for 25 years, so it's, I was really impressed when I first started working with Peach Pit at the morals and the ethics that permeated the whole company. It was really quite astounding. So, and they've been carrying on those, you know, that high ground all this time.
And what do you mean by that? That's a great comment.
Oh, well, for instance, when I first met with Ted and you showed me the contract for the book, and we met in Berkeley, and I said, well, frankly, I don't know what I'm looking at. I don't know if this contract is good for me or not. I trust that you're doing the right thing. Well, he told me years later he took the contract back and changed it so it would be better for me.
Oh, wow.
And how many publishers would do that?
None. That's fabulous.
I mean, most people would take it back and say, oh, good, let me fix it. And then when Peach Pit, when Ted sold it, he made sure that all those who had sort of come along with him got something out of the sale. He arranged a deal for me that, for 4 years that, gave me a part of that. And there was one person who he couldn't place in the new company, and he asked, what would you really like to do? And the guy said, I'd like to go back and get my master's as a CPA or whatever it was. So Ted put him through school.
That is amazing.
I know, it really is amazing. And then, you know, it's funny how, I mean, it's true that the fish rots from the head down, that it just takes one person to make a company kind of weaselly or icky, and one person to really make it
beautiful.
I know, a magical place. And Peach Pit started off in that magical place, and I think they've really, you know, done a great job maintaining that.
Oh, that is such a nice thing to hear. And I think especially for the kinds of books that you're writing, it hopefully encourages readers to realize that there's, you know, the integrity behind the imprint, you know, flows through. That's a wonderful thing. So as on our final note, again, celebrating the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit, do you have a book that you're most proud of as an author, and which is it?
Well, actually, it's probably the one that doesn't sell very well, but I think that's only because, I don't know why. But the book I love most is, what's it called? It's a book about using your hands to create things by hand that then you take to your digital artwork. John, do you know the name? Got earphones on. The name of the book, it's the Robin Williams Handmade Design Workshop, something like Handmade Elements for Graphic Design, Handmade Elements for Digital Design.
There you go.
Yeah. It's with a girlfriend of mine. It's actually her book, and I just helped her on it. But, oh, my gosh, I had so much fun helping her put the book together and designing the book. And I firmly believe in the whole concept behind the book, that when you let go of the computer for a while and play with your hands, and it has all these wonderful handy techniques with all kinds of stuff to play with. And then the advantage of being a digital designer is then it didn't come out perfect, but you can make it perfect.
Which is a nice thing.
Really opens up the whole world of design by going outside the computer, and I just love that book.
Well, we're out of time. time, and I thank you so much, Robin, for being a part of the celebration of the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press.
Thank you, Jennifer. 25th, right?
And I'll let you get on with your day.
You too. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you. That was Robin Williams, our Mac icon from Peach Pit Press. Folks, you can learn more about the history of Peach Pit Press on its website, peachpit.com. And we want to again thank Robin for celebrating the 25th anniversary. We hope you enjoyed the program, and please feel free to embed, download, or otherwise share the show. Please join us tomorrow, again, noon Pacific, when my guest will be author Steve Krug, web usability expert and author of Don't Make Me Think, A Common Sense Approach to Web Usability. I hope you'll join us, and thank you so much for listening.